Welcome to Alternative Realities. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, Global Market Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Over the last two decades, the alternative industry has undergone significant changes globally as investors at all levels increasingly seek the unique return, income, and diversification benefits these assets offer within their portfolios. With the growing popularity of alternatives, there's an increasing need for thought leadership to guide investors through the historic and current dynamics of various alternative asset classes. Joining me today to talk about the alternative industry in different markets around the world and what they're hearing from clients on the road are Kerry Craig and Aaron Hussain, both of whom are global market strategists here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Both Kerry and Aaron are my counterparts in Asia and Europe as part of their Global Market Insights team, with a particular focus on alternative assets. We'll talk about how alternatives are growing in popularity in each of the markets we cover, and some of the asset classes that are well positioned in the current environment, and talk about some interesting investment trends in real assets that we're seeing right now with policy shifts taking place. Aaron and Kerry, thank you very much for taking the time to join us on Alternative Realities. Before we jump in, let me give you both the opportunity to introduce yourselves to our audience and talk about your role here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Maybe Aaron, Kerry, you go first since it's coming on 10 p.m. at your time in Australia, and we appreciate you joining us at this time.
No problem, Aaron. Absolute pleasure to be on the podcast with you. My name's Kerry. I'm a global market strategist in our Market Insights team. I'm based out in Melbourne, Australia, but we cover the entire region. So our clients are basically everyone from wholesale investors right through from high net worth and private banks and all the way up to institutional clients. So cover the broad spectrum around the region. I've been with the team for a number of years now. I was initially based out in London covering European clients, but you know, as our APAC business has grown, have relocated back down to Australia to help cover clients here.
Great, and Aaron?
Yeah, Aaron, thanks very much for having me on the podcast. Similar to both of you, I'm also a global market strategist in the Market Insights team, but I'm based in London. Again, I also have a focus on alternatives. And like Kerry and yourself, I cover various different client types. So wholesale, private wealth, and institutional. I've been with the Market Insights team for just under 18 months. And prior to joining the team, I worked as a senior economist at CBRE, so focusing on commercial real estate.
Fantastic. So very, very good to have you both here with us this morning, this afternoon, this evening. One of the topics I was really interested in exploring with you both is just the state of alternatives in your respective regions. So here in the US, we're in the very early stage of the democratization of alternatives as they're becoming more accessible outside of institutional investors. And it's progressing very quickly. And I'm curious about internationally, what we see in APAC, what we see in Europe, and how that's going. So maybe, Aaron, I'll start with you first. In Europe, how have alternatives evolved in Europe generally, and how are clients using them today?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in Europe, as in the US, alternatives have evolved from a relatively small part of the financial ecosystem in the early 2000s to a much larger part of the financial ecosystem today. And to put that into context, in the early 2000s, across all alternative asset classes, there was around 100 billion in AUM. You fast forward to today, that's closer to 3 trillion. So we've seen tremendous growth in alternatives over the last two decades. I think if we think about the drivers of that, initially, of course, it was driven by the low interest rate environment, particularly post the global financial crisis. We know that many institutions were searching for yield because fixed income was delivering very low returns. But also we had regulatory changes like Solvency II, which made it more attractive for institutional investors to allocate to alternatives because they have lower capital charges due to their lower volatility and lack of mark to market. Initially, allocations were dominated in hedge funds and real estate. But now the market's expanded to include private equity, private credit, and infrastructure. I think the big challenge over the last two decades is that, of course, alternatives have really been the realm of institutional investors. So ultra high net worths and institutions were able to access alternatives, but everybody else, so smaller family offices, and retail investors have not historically been able to access alternatives. Two recent developments in Europe are now, as you said, democratizing access to alternatives, extending it so that high net worth individuals, but also retail investors, can now start accessing alternative investments. The first is regulatory frameworks such as LTIF, which stands for the European Long-Term Investment Fund, and LTAF, which is the Long-Term Asset Fund. They're regulatory frameworks in Europe and the UK, now permit retail investors access to these illiquid investment vehicles. So we've got regulatory compliant vehicles. The second is the rise of open-ended or evergreen investment vehicles, which offer more liquidity than the traditional limited life drawdown funds that we've seen historically in private markets. So I think the combination of those two is really now broadening access to a much broader base of investors.
Okay, that's really interesting. So we're seeing kind of the opening up of alternatives to a broader range of investors, but kind of different regulatory environment, obviously, than we have in the US, and kind of evolving at a different pace and through different means. Hey, Kariela, I'll put the same question to you. How has the story of alternatives evolved over time in the APAC region?
But it's not too dissimilar to what Aaron described there. I think that there's been, a relatively slower transition to thinking about the role that alternatives play in a portfolio, the characteristics they offer in terms of, replicating or collaborating and supporting the role of public market assets in a portfolio. But that's definitely accelerating, seeing increased interest in them. And it's also worth noting that when we talk about APAC as a region, that's a very big region. And there's a lot of different markets with a lot of different regulatory environments, a lot of different investor types, and a lot of different attitudes towards how they like to invest. So if we take markets like Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, obviously, alternatives are much more dominant in those places, largely through that institutional sphere. So Australia is a clear case. We have, this massive pensions industry, these very long-term sort of views on their liabilities, and obviously liquidity is not a hurdle for them. And so they've been, a huge factor in thinking about the growth of that here in Australia. And then you take markets like Japan. I mean, obviously private equity has been still a very popular asset class in Japan. You've had the benefit of very, very low interest rates for a very long time. You've had more recently a weaker currency, a lot more deal activity and exits happening there than perhaps what you've seen in the US more recently, given the turmoil in the markets. So I think it's slightly different views depending on the market you're looking at. It has, as Aaron mentioned, again, been that realm of mainly, the people who have a bit more of a threshold for having illiquidity and holding those illiquid assets, the investors with very long time horizons who can kind of ride out that sort of lockup periods that come with these assets. And so it has been traditionally held by those ultra high net worth private banks, institutions. But again, we're seeing it start to shift here to a degree. It's not moved right into the wholesale spectrum, like maybe perhaps you're seeing it in Europe, as Aaron described, but definitely becoming more attentive in portfolios for those in the sort of high net worth space and thinking about, how they can benefit or get some of the benefit that institutional investors have been having for some time, particularly as they see the challenges in the public markets over the last few years that have become all too apparent around, correlated assets becoming more correlated, or looking for income, or thinking about, how to hedge off inflation risks in a portfolio. So they're really starting to grow a little bit more. But, I'm always a little bit conscious about thinking around APAC as a region, because it is very separate markets and very separate clients that are interested in different types of assets.
You've got a very big region to cover. And I spent a little bit of time in Australia myself. I worked there for about a year, and I'm actually due an Australian pension when I retire from that year of work. And I know that it's been invested in alternatives, in infrastructure. I want to get back to that maybe a little bit later in this conversation, because I think that's
there's actually a small piece of road that has your name on it. That's your infrastructure. It's okay. Known as the Aaron Highway. It's just outside Cairns. It's
there. Already getting back to it. Checking that out. I want to shift gears here a little bit and talk about what are the big topics that you've been hearing about lately on the road from clients. I know you're traveling across your various regions, meeting with clients every day. Are you seeing position changes in asset classes over the last several months, particularly with the uptick in volatility in public markets? What are you hearing from? I would say from my perspective in the United States, we've got we're hearing a lot more interest in international, not just in public markets, but from investors wanting to be diversified internationally across private assets. So Aaron, I'll start with you maybe in Europe and then kick it over to Kerry for his take on the Asia and Australia region. What are you hearing from clients lately in terms of views and positioning?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the big themes we're obviously hearing when we're out on the road talking to clients is that renewed focus on portfolio resilience. For much of the last two decades, investors could rely on the negative relationship between stocks and bonds. So when times were good, equity markets were going up. And when times were bad or the market, you know, perceived an economic slowdown, we saw shifts into fixed income, their prices went up and they acted as a nice diversifier in the portfolio. But since 2022, that relationship's obviously become far less reliable. So investors are now looking for assets that can protect them from two-sided risks, risks that emanate from a growth slowdown, but also risks that emanate from an increase in inflation. So I think on the retail side, there's this acknowledgement that we need a much broader toolkit to protect the portfolio from a range of different shocks. Historically, as we mentioned just a moment ago, the big challenge for retail investors by and large is that they haven't been able to access these alternative investments. So while they understand the attributes and the benefits they can bring the portfolio, there's not really been any way for them to access many of these alternative asset classes. But as we just addressed, I think that's changing. On the institutional side, I think it's slightly different because they've already had pretty sizable allocations to alternatives over the last 10, 15 years. On average, that allocation across all institutions is around 20%. And if you look at foundations or endowments, for example, you know, those allocations can be anywhere upwards of 30%. So we've already seen sizable allocations to alternatives. So when you talk to clients on the institutional side, what you hear actually is that most of them say that the alternative allocations they have broadly met or exceeded their expectations, whether that's delivering the returns they expected, delivering the stability of income that they expected, or just those uncorrelated return streams that we've mentioned. As a result of that, the vast majority of them, when surveyed, suggest that they're looking to increase or maintain their current allocations. So broadly speaking, on the institutional side, it looks as though allocations to alternatives are set to increase. When we look at the asset classes that are most in favor at the moment, it's similar to what Kerry said in APAC, it's private equity, it's private credit. We know it's delivered very attractive returns over the last 10 years, particularly as those interest rates rose, it becomes relatively more attractive than equity. And of course, infrastructure, both on the equity side, but also on the debt side.
And Kerry, what are you hearing from clients on the road lately?
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar story. I mean, the ghost of 2022 is still there, right? It's a bit of a shadow over the markets as we think about, you know, what does the growth rate and the inflation rate actually start to look like? You know, stagflation. The narrative obviously changes quite frequently with the outlook for trade and the announcements. And, you know, as we head in towards these negotiations between the US and many other countries, there's still a huge amount of uncertainty. And I think that's the thing that we hear the most from clients is like, they just don't like the uncertainty that comes with public markets. They're looking for opportunities. They think so and thinking about, you know, when equities get cheaper, what does that actually mean for their public asset holdings? But they're also looking for a bit more stability, a bit more dependability, and considering how much of that, you know, liquidity budget they can start to give up, and perhaps maybe you've been overestimating how much liquidity they actually need relative to the benefits that come with these assets. Again, it does differ by market. So if we think more broadly, yeah, private equity has been a huge one, particularly as we've seen that growth in the secondaries market that's come through, and real assets obviously has dominated that as well. So you just think about the electrification of many industries, the electrification of many economies, the electrical needs that are driven by the growth in data centers for the whole AI theme, very popular things we see investors focused on in terms of where they allocate and towards the real asset space, as well as just the genuine need for infrastructure build out around the world. But I think, again, it does vary by market when you break it down. So take Japan again, we talked about private equity a little bit, but there you have a market where you can see that there's been actually increasing in households. They've had rising wages that's playing through to the real estate market. You're actually seeing that becoming an area of interest. for investors as they think about, you know, just the need and demand for the homes in the Japanese market. You've seen it sort of spill over in terms of thinking around those data centers and other things around some of the ASEAN markets or Asian markets as well. So again, it's a very different conversation when it comes to the outlook for real estate. Whereas in the US, I'm sure you're talking about office, you know, the return to work. That wasn't a big conversation for many parts of the Asian economies, because you didn't stay at home to work. People just was in the office because that was how it worked. I mean, again, Australia is still going through that return to the office, but in other markets, it really wasn't the case. And then there's like niche areas coming up on that real estate side as well. So one of the more prominent themes that's coming up here in Australia is actually the outlook for student accommodation. It's a relatively small share of the market, but again, take Victoria, Australia, where I live, you know, education is the biggest export for the state. And so there's a huge reliance on thinking about student numbers and obviously where those students are going to house themselves if they're international students. And so that's creating opportunities there, as well as things like logistics around the region. And I think that's going to become more important too. Obviously, again, we're weighing the economic outlook from tariffs and trade, but we're also thinking about what that means for supply chains, the reshuffling of those supply chains, the need for that infrastructure build out that comes with it. Think about new ports that have to be built, new railways, new, you know, cable networks and fiber optics to support all that. And again, thinking about the movement and people. So there's still a huge amount of potential around that real assets and real estate side in the Asian markets. But for here and now, I mean, the conversations are largely around sort of, again, the private equity, the secondary market, given the growth that we've seen in there and some of the challenges we're still seeing in M&A so far in the US, and thinking about some of those other opportunities that come through on both the infrastructure side, thinking about transport a little bit more as well, and then again, and thinking about the private markets more broadly in terms of private equity.
Yeah, so such a massive variety. So you've got the emerging markets story playing out there in Asia, as well as the trade diversification situation. And you mentioned infrastructure and maybe getting back to that road that's out there somewhere in Canberra named after me. Can you touch on that, just that story of like how infrastructure investing got started in Australia? Because it started there, and then it sort of moved to Europe and then the US. When you look at a lot of financial markets charts, you typically expect the United States to be the biggest share of the pie, and it's often the most developed, but actually in many ways Australia has the most mature infrastructure market in the world, and it's I think we're learning the lessons from what Australia put together a number of years ago.
Yeah, I guess confluence of two really key things that happened pretty close together. The first was around deregulation in the sort of the 1980s. You know, that happened in many parts of the world. I can think about the UK and New Zealand, the 1980s. There's a lot of privatization of state-owned assets. That's what happened in Australia in the 80s. You had a government that came in, wanted to sell off a big chunk of its infrastructure holdings, was also selling off things like telecoms and those other things to fund like basically sovereign wealth funds, but selling off a lot of its infrastructure. And that was also happening at a time where you had the superannuation industry being set up. So you had, again, these super funds that were coming in. They were just bringing in large amounts of money from, you know, compulsory savings from workers who are putting it into their pension funds, and they were looking for opportunities. And there, the right presented to them was this ability to invest in these really long-term assets that generated the income. And so that really came together. So you had assets that came for sale, some very fortuitous investors who got together and said, you know, let's create an infrastructure fund and be able to sell it on to these investors who are looking for these long duration assets, as they were in terms of the super industry. And it just kept going because you just had this huge growth in the super fund. Compulsory super has gone up over time. It's now close to 12% now of your pay goes into your super fund. And the infrastructure outlook has just continued to build off the back of that. And over time, as those domestic funds have got bigger and bigger, they started looking for opportunities overseas, both in terms of assets they could own, but also in terms of investors who would invest into them. So you've just seen the Australian industry start to set up offices in New York and London as they look for those global opportunities and look for investors to get into their funds. So it's really starting back to the fact you've had that positive point of view of, you know, deregulations, assets that came for sale at a time when you had the pension and super fund industry really getting kicked going on its feet. And so just the marrying of those two forces really allowed the industry to explode.
Thanks for that, Kerry. I think it's such an interesting and little known story, especially here in the US, and at a time where we're starting to talk about alternatives being part of 401ks and pension plans. And there's a model there in Australia that I think there's a lot to learn from. Going back to Europe, Aaron, kind of continuing maybe a theme of infrastructure, we saw Germany's massive new infrastructure package make its way through Parliament earlier this year. Do you think this can be a tailwind for increased infrastructure spending in the European region, or what's your take on this?
Yeah, so as you say, in March of this year, Germany approved a new infrastructure and climate fund, so a 500 billion euro fund. It's one of the most ambitious public investment programs in its post-war history, so it's certainly sizable. And it's aimed at modernizing its infrastructure, which of course needs upgrading. That's true in Europe, but also true elsewhere in the world. It's also being used to accelerate the energy transition and to meet some of the net zero climate ambitions that Germany and the European Union has too. Yeah. The fund is looking to be deployed over a period of 12 years. So that's averaging around 42 billion annually. But from a private capital perspective, I think this is certainly a positive signal, right? It brings scale, it brings visibility, and I'm sure it's going to bring some momentum to the European infrastructure pipeline. So they're positives. It should also hopefully accelerate some of the much needed reforms to planning and permitting, which of course massively slow down large infrastructure projects in Europe, but also elsewhere. And as you say, hopefully it will stimulate some broader EU level initiatives and stimulate some cross-border investment. So I think on the whole, it's a positive thing. But taking a step back, you know, the German public fund is just one piece of a much bigger puzzle. Across the whole of Europe, we need to upgrade and modernize our infrastructure. We're trying to fund the energy transition, and we're also trying to diversify the energy mix in Europe so that we're less reliant on imported fossil fuels. And of course, the demand from those three factors, energy demand, energy security, and the energy transition, are huge. As Kerry mentioned, we're talking about the electrification of most of the transport in Europe, the exponential energy demand that comes from data centers, AI computing, and cloud computing. We're talking about trying to build out renewable capacity, whether that's hydro or wind farms or upgrading grid capacity. And it's clear that these challenges can't be met by public funding alone. You know, outside of the developments that we've seen in Germany, most European countries have limited fiscal space. So I think there's a huge need to pair that long-term private capital with public initiatives to drive forward the infrastructure agenda that we've laid out over the next decade. So I think it's certainly a very positive development. Hopefully it brings some of that visibility and scale that allows private capital to pair with public capital to build out and generate stable returns for private investors pairing with that public capital.
Clearly a massive opportunity there and really changes the game in Europe in many ways in terms of the investment opportunities and help your clients keep a pulse on that as that develops in the months and years to come. I'd like to wrap up our conversation with both of you giving a prediction for private markets over the next 12 to 18 months. What asset classes do you think investors will favor and why? From my perspective, I can see definitely a resurgence in small to mid market private equity, as there is just a huge interest in ensuring that supply chains are diversified, not just for manufacturing, but distribution. And we're seeing this in the last couple of months, and a longer term trend that started probably with COVID and is continuing amidst the political uncertainty. In Asia and Europe, maybe Kerry, starting with you in Asia, what are the opportunities that you see in the market for investors in the coming kind of 12 to 18 months timeframe?
I think every investor is just looking for, like, where's the value, right? Where's the opportunity at this present time? And as I think you rightly mentioned, it's in the private equity space to a degree. I think the impact that we saw around, you know, things that even institutional investors need liquidity at some point if the markets aren't behaving, those forced portfolio rebalancings that we saw a couple of years ago. I mean, there's a risk that if the public markets Even though doing a little bit better of late, you know, have another leg down, you could see more of that. And I think that's where many investors are looking for saying there might be a near-term opportunity. I think on the flip side of that is, again, that rotation into more fixed income like assets in a portfolio. As we talked about that stock bond correlation going through a bit of a regime shift when we think about we're going to have more inflation because of trade in most parts of the world. So therefore, those correlations are going to be a little bit less negative than they were. How do I build that out? Obviously, that feeds right into real assets to a degree. So I think that'll be a continued shift we see in portfolios in terms of our clients. And the other thing behind that, which we didn't touch on, and I know this does change by what part of the world you're in and attitudes towards it, but you know, sustainability is still a big feature of portfolios in Australia, particularly around the pension industry. They're looking at things like infrastructure and real assets because you can use them or think about them as a way to decarbonize portfolios. I mean, timber falls into that remit as well. Probably more similar to perhaps, you know, what Aaron is talking about in Europe, and probably maybe a little bit more what you're talking about in the US, but you know, income can be, you know, not the topic of du jour for every market. So I think real assets will stay very much front and center because of those both fixed income characteristics, but because of a tilt towards thinking about the sustainability benefit for them in a portfolio for a large chunk of those big institutional investors around Australia, but you know, maybe a little bit more into the region as well. And I think you also see maybe attitudes towards private credit trying to change a little bit in Asia as well. It hasn't been front and center as much, but I think you could see that being a growing area as well.
Thanks, Kerry. I think that's always fascinating how trends can change and move between regions, but something that's maybe not in vogue here for a few years suddenly becomes in vogue in Asia or Australia, and it's helpful having all of us in the various regions as we can kind of move about. You've moved from London back to Australia, and you know, we can share what we're seeing on calls like this. Aaron, in Europe, what are you seeing in terms of opportunities in the next kind of 12 to 18 months time frame? What are you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I broadly agree with Kerry here. I think in the current uncertain macro environment, I think we'll continue to see investors gravitating towards asset classes that are uncorrelated with public markets, that generate a large part of their return from income, that have a degree of inflation protection, whether that's through the lease or through contracted pricing, contracted revenue. So I think we'll continue to see sustained demand for core real assets, especially core infrastructure. I think it demonstrated its resilience in 2022, and since 2022, it's continued to perform very well. So I think we'll continue to see flows into infrastructure. If we look at net flows in Europe in 2024, the trends that we see broadly support that perspective. On the retail side, we have started to see strong flows into ELTIF compliant funds. And I think that's an acknowledgement that retail investors are trying to get access to some of these uncorrelated income streams and these more resilient alternative asset classes. And when we look at the institutional side, we saw large flows into non-directional hedge funds. So again, trying to capture that uncorrelated income stream, but also infrastructure and private debt. So I think broadly, I agree with Kerry that it's going to be core real assets, particularly infrastructure and hedge funds, which I know we haven't talked about, but I think relative value hedge funds, uncorrelated absolute return strategies tend to do very well in volatile environments. So I think that's why we're seeing the flows there too. I think if we look slightly further out, I have to say this, maybe it's because I spent a long time in commercial real estate, but I'm increasingly constructive on commercial real estate. Over the last couple of years, we've seen pretty sizable valuation adjustments in real estate, in some cases down 20, 30%. So now you've got valuations that are, you know, the most attractive they've been in well over a decade. And if we look back to prior cycles where we saw these sorts of value corrections, the next decade tended to be very, very very, very prosperous and great for return. So I think we're moving into that environment. So I'm also constructive on commercial real estate over a medium term horizon.
Yeah, definitely a very important time to be diversified across uncorrelated assets and then internationally in particular. Thank you very much for joining us today and Kerry for joining in the late evening and almost nighttime your time, and Aaron in the late afternoon. Early morning here in New York. Really appreciate you joining on Alternative Realities, and giving our audience your insights into the global alternatives industry and the kind of discussions you're having with clients lately. To all our viewers and listeners, we hope you've enjoyed today's conversation and thank you very much for joining us. You can download the Guide to Alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website to stay informed on the latest developments in alternatives. And please subscribe to the Alternative Realities podcast and all the major platforms.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.